right. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever and whenever you might be listening. My name's Frank Duncan, and you're listening to the Backfield Banter Podcast, a podcast about baseball and just a few guys that enjoy talking about baseball. Again, I'm Frank Duncan. I'm here with Zach McLeod, Bob Zimmerman, Brian Seymour, Daniel Harper, and the man behind the computer, Will Stevens. Today, we've got a really big day. I think it is no exaggeration to say that this is the biggest day for the podcast. It's our fourth episode, and we're just moving up in the world. We're going to be talking to Mr. Jeff Passan. I'm going to just give you a brief introduction on Jeff if you guys are kind of wondering, oh, I know that name. Where do I know that name from? Well, you've probably seen him pop up on your phone screen when he's breaking some big news about players in the MLB. You might have seen him on SportsCenter. He's been on Get Up, the Pat McAfee Show. He's written two books, The Arm and Death to the BCS. He's been a member of the Baseball Writers Association of America since 2004, so congratulations on the 20-year.
Congratulations on being old. Thank you. I appreciate that.
National Sports Writer of the Year, 2021-2023. He also received the Dan Jenkins Medal of Excellence in Sports Writing for the story he wrote about Drew Robinson, one of the minor league baseball players who had an experience with suicide and then coming back from his attempted suicide. The baseball knowledge is going to be huge today, and so we're really excited to talk to him. Just quickly, I'm going to hand it off to you. That's some of your accolades, but tell us about who you are, where you're from, and how you've gotten to be here with us today at Premier.
My name is Jeff Passan, and I'm doing a podcast in a bathroom right now, so this is a first, and the decor around here is delightful. I appreciate you guys.
Did you say it's
me.
A milestone moment in the career?
No, I think it exceeds milestone. I think this feels like an apex moment. It only goes.
If the sauna was a little bigger, we'd be in there.
That's a women's bed.
I wasn't going to include that part. I appreciate you putting that in. I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. Father was a sports writer at the Cleveland Plain Dealer and did sports talk radio on the weekends. So I was in the newsroom and I was in the radio booth with him. And I topped out at 5'9 with slightly above average athleticism. So actually playing the game was not going to be in my future. And I decided if I'm not going to be able to play it, the coolest thing I could do is write about it. And started covering off college basketball in Fresno, California for a couple of years. Got the national baseball writer job at the Kansas City Star. I was 23 years old. I was horrifically underqualified. But thankfully, the people there saw something in me. I later learned that what they were looking for was somebody who is cheap and did not have a girlfriend. So I fit the bill really well, and I did nothing but work for a couple of years there. Went to Yahoo Sports after that. Spent 13 years there and am entering, this seems weird, my sixth year at ESPN now covering baseball. And I believe my 22nd year overall covering the game.
Very cool. And going back to Cleveland, Ohio, was baseball always kind of a special sport for you?
Yeah, it was, because you have to remember where the Indians were in my formative years. Like, I first saw them at Municipal Stadium back in the 80s, and it was a 75,000-seat football stadium where 2,000 people would go to watch shitty baseball. And it was like the 80s Indians sucked. But John Hart comes in as general manager. They start building up a good farm system. And really, what we've seen with long-term extensions signed by young players and especially pre-arbitration players, that was a practice that was started with the Indians in the mid-1990s. They got Kenny Lofton for a long-term deal, Albert Bell, Carlos Baerga. Those teams had Jim Thomae and Manny Ramirez, Eddie Murray, a Hall of Famer. Bartolo Colon came sort of toward the end, Oral Hershiser, Dennis Martinez. Like, I think, make a very good argument that the 90s Indians were the most talented team ever not to win at least one World Series. So I got to see some incredible baseball growing up, and that more than anything fostered my love for the sport, which is why every time I look at people who live in Kansas City now, I'm like, you guys are lucky that you get to see Bobby Witt and that you get to see Salvador Perez and Vinny Pasquantino and Cole Reagans and Seth Lugo and on, because having a baseball team that's good in your city, I think, is the greatest bridge to fandom that exists.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. Now, I was talking about Kansas City. Premier Baseball, we're a facility here in Leawood. Obviously, in this business, I think from the playing side and the coaching side too, it's really about who you know. How do you know the facility? How do you know Bob? And how did you guys kind of get connected here? And I know I've seen your kid in here a few times throwing and stuff, and it's always fun when you get to come in. We get to chat baseball.
When did we meet? Was it 19?
No, 16.
16.
It was right after you wrote the book.
Yes.
Or as you were finishing the book, I guess, at the old facility in 99th and Flom.
Okay. Yes. And it was Riley Pint was working out, right?
Yep. Riley and Joey were throwing, and you came in.
I did. And that was right when the arm came out.
Yep.
The thing I love about where baseball has gone is that these sorts of places did not used to exist. Like, even to an extent, when, how old are you guys? In 20s?
32.
32. All right.
We're old. Yeah.
What was the closest thing to a premiere when you were growing up?
That's such a good question.
I mean, I wasn't prepared to answer some good questions. I was just going to try and ask them.
So. Well, that's just bad for you. I mean, a reporter's coming in here, and you're not prepared for me to turn it on you? Come on.
It's Jerry Daniels. Jerry Daniels in St. Louis.
I mean, here, like, wasn't a facility as much in Kansas City when I was growing up, but there was, like, McIntyre's building, Championsville. Those were really the only things. I was a college coach for a long time, so you're going to these showcases, and there's a million club teams and facilities now, and I coached at the level I also played at, a smaller four-year school, and you get a couple guys that are in early 2010s to 2015 that are 92 on a NAIA D2 school, right? Those guys are throwing hard. I go back coaching it. A couple years ago, and it's everybody has guys like that. So it's the game has just progressed so much where pitchers are throwing harder, guys are way more physical now, breaking balls are way sharper. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, and it's not a surprise because when you have those individualized lessons, you're bound to get better. But I think it also takes coaches with a wide breadth of understanding and knowledge. And that was when I talked with Bob for the first time, and subsequently what appealed to me about him as a coach. It wasn't just, I'm going to get your kid to throw harder. It was, this is how he needs to learn to move. And all of those things, the additional strength, the work that you put in, the biomechanics, are going to eventually lead to him throwing harder or becoming a better baseball player. But Bob didn't stress the velo as much as he did the process. And that's the sort of thing that appealed greatly to my son, who is now 17. And I'm not going to describe him. An analytical kid? Is that
very cerebral, yeah.
Yeah. You said it, not me.
I think it's funny because I kind of went the other way where growing up in San Francisco, you can't have a facility like this. It just doesn't make sense, the overhead and the land and everything. So I remember my first experience with pitching coaching and getting pitching lessons was Fred Brining, who used to play with the Giants back in the day. And he had his lessons in an insulation warehouse where I had to kind of sift my way through all the insulation to get to the cage. And I remember it wasn't anything, but like I did my bands and then I warmed up my arm and got off the mound for probably 30 minutes, 45 minutes. And it was, at least I learned how to pitch and I could throw strikes. But as far as the body and like you talk about the biomechanics and all that stuff that we have now, that was an afterthought. For me, it was just about here, this is how we're going to pitch. We're going to put, he had the glove that he would put on the tee. And I would throw to that, and I'd see how many times I could knock it off the tee. And that's probably why I don't throw very hard today.
Is it like the asbestos inside the insulation farm that you threw in?
That was an experience, though. You brought up the arm, and the arm being kind of the book that, I'm not going to say put you on the map because I don't think that's fair, but it is something that came together when all of us came together, when you and Bob at least came together in Premier. I know Daniel is very curious about that because
I read it when I was having Tommy John in high school. And so it was very eye-opening to me.
I was going
to
say, did it terrify you? Did it bring you solace? Somewhere in between?
Both. Yeah, like understanding the process before I had it was really good. And then understanding you can't come back from it was big time for me.
Yeah, and it came from a conversation I had with Alex Anthopoulos, who's now the president of baseball operations for the Atlanta Braves. At the time, he was with the Toronto Blue Jays. And I was working on a story because Dylan Bundy had just been drafted and was throwing like two inning starts. And the Blue Jays had a trio of prospects, Noah Syndergaard, Aaron Sanchez, and Justin Nicolino, all of whom were being limited as well. And this is the same question that I've been asking for well over a decade now, because this was in 2012. But I asked him, why, if you are trying to create 7, 8, 9 inning pitchers at the major league level, are you limiting them to two innings down at the minor league level? And Alex, who was always very candid and very forthright, said, I don't know. Now, he's a bright guy. He is a thoughtful guy. He's somebody who considers these things. And so if he, someone whose job it is to go and create major league pitchers, is saying, I don't know, that's a pretty damning, not just a damning thing to say, but a damning indictment on where the baseball industry is in terms of pitching development. And, you know, at the time, I'm 32 years old, and I don't think I know everything, but certainly I can find the solution to this. All these people who have looked, they're just not looking in the right place. I wound up spending 4 years and ending up in the same place that I did at the beginning, which is that I don't know shit either. but that has continued on. And for all the, it's interesting to me, for all the progress that has been made in development of pitchers, of stuff, of spin, of carry, of all the measurables that they're looking for, we haven't made any progress in terms of keeping guys healthy while still performing like that. And it's so fascinating to me that the baseball industry collectively has more or less, and this, by the way, this is the front offices, this is the players themselves, and you guys all can speak to this because you guys were all in positions where you had to ask yourself that question, is what I'm doing that's potentially hurting me right now worth it? And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but the answer from every damn player out there is yep.
Yeah.
Yep, because the big leagues is where it could wind up if everything breaks right, and it will have been worth it at that point.
Yeah, and I actually believe that there was just a study that was released by the MLB talking about the relationship between injuries and pitching and how the pitching has developed. They said they relate it to stuff. People are just throwing harder. They're nastier. Their goal is to create unbelievable arsenal of weapons as far as from a pitching side. And now that you have the technology to do it, you can spend all offseason and all season doing it.
I'm glad I'm in a room of athletes here, because somebody really crystallized this to me yesterday, and I'm curious what your guys' thoughts are on it. We can look at the correlation between velocity and arm injuries. It's a strong correlation, especially, you know, the harder you throw, the more forces there are on the elbow, the more stress, the more strain, the likelier it is to get hurt. But this is a pitching coach on the college level, and he said it's not just the velo, it's the chasing of outlier pitches. And it just occurred to me when he said that, outliers are outliers for a reason. When did outlier become the goal?
I think that's a good question. I'm usually the only non-pitcher in here, so this is great. I just think this many people aren't supposed to throw 95. Like, I think that's really what it is. If you threw 90 in high school, when we were in high school, you were a dude. Okay, there are so many kids that walk in and out of here that throw 90. We just had a kid, what was a step behind, at like 100.
Shout out Tyler Wood.
That is crazy. And this many people just aren't meant to do that. And so it is probably chasing the outliers, because not everybody's body works that way naturally. Okay, so that's probably the first part of it. And the second part is, like, you're creating so much force, especially at a young age. And you'll see these kids, and we talk about all the time, like, you're 170 pounds and you're throwing 94. Your injury risk is going to go up. That's just a fact. You look at a lot of these big league pitchers, and they're still getting hurt. I think the average pitcher I looked at the other day, it was like 205 or 210 in the big leagues. Like, that's a big guy. And you look at these guys that are in and out of here, all of our pro guys, they're just big people.
Yeah, I see this with my own son, right? I am 5'9" on a good day. And somehow, he's almost 6'2" now. And that child eats more food in a week than anyone else in the house eats in a month. Because he wants to gain weight, he wants to get stronger, he wants to get bigger, mass equals gas, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like, that's the path now, right? And in baseball, there's a real cookie cutter culture, and generally it's been organizationally, right? An organization does something that succeeds, other organizations follow. But now, if you are not a fucking monster, you are not going to pitch in the big leagues unless you are as special as it gets. Unless you're Spencer Strider, and by the way, he's like his legs are those of a monster.
Yeah.
You know, unless you're Tim Lincecum, who just
the freak.
Yeah, the way that he created energy and momentum, that's a true outlier.
Yeah.
Right.
That pitcher for the Cubs, what was it,
Carl Edwards.
Yeah, Junior. Like he's another guy, or like Tristan McKenzie. Like he's really thin, and
yep.
Chris Sale and stuff. But even when Chris Sale, like on the scouting side, he quote unquote dropped in the draft to somewhere around like 13, because there were concerns that they're like, hey, are we drafting him and he's going to end up getting shoved into the bullpen because we don't know if he can carry 200 innings year in and year out.
Yeah,
and your body mass does matter for just injury prevention sake.
For me, the idea of chasing the outlier pitch is we now can identify outlier pitches much easier, and behind the metrics and all the technology that we have within baseball. Now, if I go on whatever Baseball Savant or whatever thing, I can see what Justin Verlander's curveball is doing, or I can see what Chris Sale's slider is doing. And then I can actually go in here now and get on the mound and try and recreate that. It used to be when I was coming up and trying to not, and this is before pro ball, because I think it did start around like 2014-ish, but you didn't know, right? The only way you knew if your slider was good is if you threw it and it didn't hit any bats, you know? You got swings and misses. So then that, for me, it was like, all right, like, I don't need to make it better. I'm getting swings and misses on those pitches. That's a good pitch. And I continue to take that up to the next level. I didn't never knew why. But now with the technology being understood, it's having all these guys, and we see it in here too, with some of the pro guys too, they come in and they think that they need to add something.
Yes.
They think they need to do something that might not be natural to their anatomy.
Thank you.
And that is the part that is making it harder. I had a really good pitching coach in high A, Scott Ellerton, shout out.
I covered him on the 2000.
He was on the Indians, Royals? I think, right?
No, he was with the Royals.
Royals, and then I think he was with the Phillies too.
He bounced around a lot.
Yeah, but so great pitching coach. But he got me in high A. It was my first full season in pro ball, and I'm throwing a fastball, curveball, I'm throwing like six different pitches, and he looks at me. He's like, "What are your three best pitches?" And I'm like, "Oh, I guess like this and this." And he's like, "Just throw those then. You don't need to throw more stuff. You just need to get better at throwing a few things and being really good at that." And that's what the trouble is now, is when you have the TrackMan set up and you've got kids coming in here, it's like, oh, I want to work on my screwball today. And like, or I want to throw Chris Davinsky's changeup or screwball, I think it is.
Yeah.
And it's just like, no, he's just throwing a changeup. It's just really good. We don't need to go try and recreate that. We just need to get good at what we're doing. And then the rest of it will take care of itself. We can chase outliers now. We used to not have an idea, but now we at least know.
Two things. One, if you can replicate it, it's probably not an outlier, because that means other people are going to be able to do the same. But beyond that, I think the most important point that you made there is that we're ignoring, I'm not going to say motor preferences, because there's plenty of people out there who believe, are you a pronator, are you a supinator, how does your arm path work, all of that, and that you should not design pitches to the TrackMan, but design pitches to your pathology internally. And that's something that just gets ignored because you see some nasty shit and you're like, I want to do that. And now you have a tool that allows you to try and do it, but at what cost?
Yeah.
That's the unknown. And the unknown drives so much of the decision-making in baseball. It goes back to Alex Anthopoulos saying, I don't know. And what he meant by that is, I don't know what's going to keep guys healthy. But I think your point is really illustrative of the fact that performance and specifically those numbers on pitches are what pitchers are now chasing instead of the other things, whether outs, conditioning. And I'm not saying just cardiovascular conditioning, but we certainly have prioritized strength, bulk, and mass over flexibility and durability. And you wonder why we have pitchers who throw five innings and then are out of there now. It's not just the third time through the order penalty. Yeah. It's that guys get babied in the minor leagues because organizations are frightened that their investments are going to break and that it's going to reflect poorly on them, and that if they don't draft and develop guys well that and at least get them to the big leagues, that they're going to lose their jobs for it. So they just take it easy on them, and then you have guys getting to the big leagues trying to get out the best hitters in the world, which is damn near impossible without the proper tool set to do them. It's just illogical to me the way that pitchers are reared right now. I was talking with somebody who's a player development coordinator in an organization, and he was saying if it were up to me, and my organization doesn't listen to me on this, but if it were up to me, our starting pitchers in the minor leagues would lead the minors in innings pitched every year because that's what we're trying to build, right? But instead, it's just a bunch of donkeys who can throw really hard and you hope that they can figure out how to stay healthy and get over the plate.
Yeah. The goals have shifted a little bit. I always was like, if I lead the team in innings pitched or I lead the league in innings pitched, that usually means you're doing a good job at your job, you know? And so, like, if that is your goal, the rest of the things will fall into place. You know, but now it's more about like, oh, I went two innings, but I struck out five guys. Awesome. Like, okay, yeah. I mean, but we could have gone four and zero. We could have gone four innings, zero runs, and maybe just punched out two, and that still would have been good. But it's just the shift of like goals. But a little bit of that is, I think we're going back to the book again, is the guys who get paid are usually the guys that punch out the most guys, but they're also throwing up zeros.
And it's how you keep your job too. Like, yep. In the minor leagues, like, stuff keeps your job. You're cutting down to 165 this year. If you don't throw hard, you better be getting outs all the time.
Does the MLB have injury data on all this as far as,
yes,
like how much guys are throwing through the minors?
Yes.
And is it just rapidly increased injury rates?
This was all in the report that the league put out. The injury rates, especially with the ulnar collateral ligament, have gone up significantly. The number of Tommy John surgeries and other UCL repairs have gone up. I think there was data like 20 years ago, around 50% of minor league starts went at least five innings. I think now it's down. Now it's more like 60% went at least five innings.
More starters ever.
Yeah. Now it's like 30%.
Right. Yeah.
So if five innings is the bare minimum expectation, and at least 2/3 of the preparatory games for that expectation are falling short of that, it's like, you know, if Jack, my son, comes in and he's having a session with Bob, and he's throwing, let's say the fastball's just sitting at 85, and Bob says, all right, we're going to try and hit 90 next week. No, you're not. Just as if you have been throwing 4 1/3, 4 2/3, 70 pitches, 75 pitches, going 6 or 7 at 100 pitches is not reasonable. Yeah. It's already really fucking hard to pitch. Right. Like, really, really, really hard. Now you're going against the best hitters in the world. Now you know if you have a bad out and you may get sent back down. So there's a mental component to it. Right. At very least, the physical should be the part that you don't have to worry about.
Mm-hmm. On the hitting end, right, I see training has gotten a little bit better the last few years because now you're seeing a lot of the popular stuff on Twitter, like the water bags and things like that to keep guys more stable. And I think the pitching end, it's exploded because you can throw miles per hour on guys, but one, it may not be useful, and two, there's a huge injury risk.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, we can do anything, but if we're doing it recklessly, it's going to be a recipe for disaster. So doing things safely and making sure that kids are built up to handle what they're doing, and I mean, this goes back to Jeff's point about guys throwing two-inning starts and then being expected to, like, hey, let's go up and try to get five. I feel like as a culture, we aren't conditioning the arm to withstand the stress that we're ultimately trying to put on it. And too often we're trying to do the fun stuff, which is like, hey, yeah, let's throw hard or a bullpen or a pull down, versus like, well, we got to take time to get there. And so like
getting there properly, being built up, like you said, making sure all the decelerator muscles, not only in strength condition, but in our correctives, in our post, or make sure the body is prepared. Like, it's so valuable and important for guys' longevity. And when guys want to skip that and go straight to the fun stuff, like, usually not a great outcome.
Yeah, and I think we see it every day with the program that we have going on in here. The last 15-ish minutes are all geared towards arm care and making sure that we're doing our arm care, making sure we're hitting different muscle groups every day. But unfortunately, we still see probably two or three guys that kind of duck out because they got something more important to do. And like the process doesn't stop when you walk off the mound. Unfortunately, whenever you're in a game starting or when you're throwing a bullpen, the process doesn't end when you throw that last pitch. You know, oftentimes it almost is just getting going because it's about taking care of the decel and making sure the brakes are strong and able to handle it.
Here's where baseball's truest and deepest problem lies, I think. It would be great if guys didn't want to just do the fun stuff. But I think characterizing it as fun stuff, there's a little more to it. It's not the fun stuff, it's the money stuff. It's the shit that gets you paid. Mm. All of this,
bingo.
All of this starts at the big league level. Because let's just go through the whole process of how this works. When you're at the big league level, what are you looking for down in the minor leagues? Teams have shown consistently that they are going to prioritize velocity over control, command, ability to go deep into games, right? So the guys who throw hard are more often than not, not always, but more often than not, going to be the ones who get called up. Thus, when you're in the minor leagues, what should your priorities be? Your priorities are going to be whatever's going to get you to the big leagues, right? Hard. So you focus on throwing hard. And it would be nice if you had Maddox control. It would be nice if you had an outlier characteristic that could maybe allow you to advance without throwing hard. But as we've learned over the last 15 years, you can learn to gain velocity. It's one of the easier things to do. It's a whole hell of a lot easier than learning command. And so you're going to focus on that velocity. How did you get into the minor leagues, though? How did you get drafted? You got drafted because guess what? You probably threw hard. Because teams have shown that bringing a guy into their organization, that they're going to focus on fastball velocity, on the nastiness of your stuff, on all of that. And so they come from either college or high school having done that. But if you're not a high school athlete who's getting drafted, how are you going to get to college? Guess what? You got to throw hard. And so all of this starts at the big league level and cascades its way down into the amateur system. But the problem is, it is going to have a Super Bowl bounce back up to harm the big leagues eventually. Because the more guys who are focusing on velocity, the likelier they are to end up getting their arms hurt. Their arms are getting hurt at a younger and younger age now. And so you see teenagers getting Tommy Johns. 33% of the pitchers drafted last year had a UCL injury. It was 5% 20 years earlier.
That's crazy.
My son had it. He's not even a pitcher.
Yeah. So all of a sudden, the player population that's going into organized baseball is broken to begin with. And when the greatest predictor of a future arm injury is a past arm injury, and you have past arm injuries and half the population to start off, what do you think it's going to be like by the time that they get back to the big leagues? Like, it's going to be a bunch of broke dicks.
And it's
like, it terrifies me for the future of the game, because all the things that I love about pitching, I worry that they're not going to be there, and I worry that we're going to have a lesser version of it. And, you know, it occurred to me a few days ago. I haven't said this to anyone, so I want to test this philosophy out on you guys and tell me, like, if I'm completely full of shit, please say so. Back in the 1950s, the Los Angeles Dodgers, Brooklyn Dodgers, would bring to their camp every year five times as many pitchers as any other organization. You know, Branch Rickey started the farm system because he saw this as a numbers game. He saw it as guys are going to get hurt, and we want to be the ones who have the most that survive that. Now, why guys were getting hurt back then was not the same reason that they are now. It was because of overuse, right? It was because you were throwing 200 pitches in a game, because you were throwing 300 innings in a season. I feel like we're at the same point right now,
but with just a different cause. It's not overuse, it's stress. And it's, if you are expected to throw 95 plus to be anything, you are automatically putting yourself into that risk category where organizations are just gonna say, you know what, there's breakage. Like, this is what happens with a product. It's what they look at pitchers like, they're a product. And products break sometimes, and sometimes the eggs spoil, and sometimes this happens. But at the end of the day, you know what, the guys who make it, those are gonna be dudes right there. Do you think those two things?
100%. Right.
Well, I think. Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
And I think the next move is going to be, well, how we fix this? Now we're going to move the mound back to help hitters because everybody's throwing 100. I mean, that's you know what I mean?
So I think it's catch-22, whether it's with the organizations or if you're talking about youth baseball, right? The way that a lot of recruiting events are set up, right? It's like exit velo, it's don't pitch velo, it's like shit. All that stuff, right? It's the process for everything,
you're absolutely right?
Because there's baseline numbers you have to hit. You might have great mechanics, do all the right things, but if you're 84, you're just not going to get Manny Machado out. It's just not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of a catch-22 where it's like, okay, we need you to throw this hard. And everybody's like, okay, well, I need to do this so I have an opportunity. And then the hard part is you get to coaches, facilities, stuff like that. For them to keep their job, they're like, okay, I have to get this guy up here. Otherwise, I'm not going to get more clients. So, yep. And then it goes over into the big leagues, into the minor leagues, all this different stuff, because that's how jobs are produced and how jobs are given. And so it's really a system issue.
Also, you're talking about the numbers of Branch Rickey starting this thing where he's like, okay, at least if one guy gets hurt, we've got 30 other guys in the farm system. But we're also going the other way with the farm system where we're cutting guys down.
Great point.
All over, and we're making that pool smaller. But also that pool's not just getting smaller, it's getting younger.
Yes.
Because now instead of having that guy you drafted at 18 years old spend a year at every level, maybe 2 years at some levels where he's at a chance to grow into his body, develop, and understand what he needs to get guys out in long periods and not just throw as hard as he can and trying to strike everybody out. Now that guy's getting shoved through the minor league system into AAA, and now he's facing adults, and all of a sudden then he gets into the big leagues, and now that the pressure is tripled, that's going to put more pressure on the body, and it's going to lead to more injuries. And we're hamstringing ourselves as organizations with limiting the pool.
But the only way I see to even sniff solution is with, you're going to have to take generations of parents that are not going to subject their kid to this.
Yep.
That's the only way you're going to change it.
But parents' behaviors are only going to change when the incentive is put in place from Major League Baseball for the rest of the culture to change.
Yeah, right.
What you guys do here is you respond to a market. Right? The market right now says, we want guys who can throw really hard, and so what are you going... Bob, you could train guys to do anything. You could train a monkey to throw a baseball. I'm convinced of that. And... no, I'm serious.
You could train Frank.
Bam!
That's crazy.
But why do you choose to train the way you do? Is it because that's what the market wants, or because you think that's the right way to train pitchers?
Well, I mean, yes and no. Like, I think our first and foremost is still everything's based on injury prevention. And so if you do things to, like, prepare your body and limit the probability of injury, you're going to get stronger, you're going to gain more mobility, you're going to get mm-hmm. more stable around the joints, velocity is going to be a byproduct.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never once said, like, hey, we're going to get you in and just get you throwing harder.
Right.
I mean, that's just a bad way to look at it.
I think one of my favorite things that we've talked about with you, and every time that somebody asks you what we do here at Premier, one of the things that you always bring up is injury prevention. And it's something that I think makes you stand out more than other people, because a lot of times it's like, you were coming here because you want to throw harder. Great. But you've approaching it from the injury prevention standpoint that you're talking about is important. Unfortunately, once the kid leaves our doors...
Yeah. Well, beyond that, sometimes when the kids are here, it happens, because you guys aren't perfect. No, right. No,
well,
group
you're
of
playing
coaches.
You're playing a risky game. It's a power production sport.
Yes.
And so your body can only do so much.
Yes.
And over time, things are going to happen. There's strength conditioning end or pitching or hitting or whatever. It's hard to get paid if you're not on the field.
That's the number one thing. Like, checks come when you're on the baseball field.
You know what the conundrum is, though? Will, how hard do you throw?
I've been up to 102.
Okay. If somebody said to you, you can only throw 98 from now on, what would you say to them?
Fuck you.
Thank you, because that was the perfect illustration of what's going on here. You can't put a restrictor plate on the arm. You can't say you're not allowed to throw this hard. What this needs is an elegant solution that doesn't tell pitchers that they can't throw at a particular velocity or with particular type of stuff. It just encourages them to prioritize other things, right? I'm curious your guys' opinions on this, because the closest thing I feel like I've heard to a solution was a few years ago. I was talking with a high-ranking executive who had seen pitching staffs balloon to 13 and sometimes 14 before the new rule was put in place that limited it. But he said, I think we should make 11-man pitching staffs. If you have an 11-man pitching staff and have limitations on the number of options and the way that you can run the train between AAA and the big leagues these days, you know, teams, by the way, 10 years ago, they averaged using 22 pitchers a season. This year, it was 32. So it's clear that they're using the minor leagues and just this litany of arms that they have to try and paper over the limitations that starting pitchers both have put on them and have put on themselves. But if you have only 11 pitchers, so let's say, Will, you're back in a rotation and you have only 11 guys on your team, and you know that if you get the shit kicked out of you in the second inning or you lose your control and Skipper has to come out and get you, that you have screwed your team for the next 3 days and potentially lost games on top of that. Would your priorities go away from velocity at that point and more to going deeper into games?
Yeah, definitely. It comes down to the team at that point. I think it's just emphasized even more.
Yeah, and athletes do what they are incentivized to do, right? In every respect, it is just a very zero-sum game. Like, I want to find the most success. What is the straightest line to get there? Right now, the incentive structure rewards people who throw hard. If Major League Baseball wants to change that and to get pitchers throwing deeper into games and potentially focusing less on velo and nastiness, then there has to be elements in place that push them toward that rather than this magnetic pull that they have toward velocity right now.
Yeah. I remember many times in college going 115, 120 pitches, which I don't think that it might not even be allowed now. You know what I'm saying?
You definitely can in college. I think from the scouting end, you have the College World Series, right, and guys throwing like 120 pitches a couple weeks in a row. They get nervous, especially if they've drafted them. But I think it's definitely done now, but I think the main issue is the framework of it. People aren't as concerned like, hey, I need my starter to go 7, and then we're going to have an 8th inning, 9th inning guy. It's more now like, hey, I need you to be as nasty as possible. I want you to try to get 5 or 6 punch outs, and then we'll cover the rest of the game with the bullpen. And the hard part now is if you're asking guys to floor it every single time, and hitters are more dangerous now because extra base hits are way more prioritized. Which Frank's got a lot of opinions on that. The reason why is, right, like, hey, I can score with 3 singles in a row, or I can hit a single and a double, and then the guy comes in. And so for the pitchers to eliminate that, they have to try to strike the guys out. The old adage, solo homers don't kill you. So if you can strike a couple guys out, you're throwing 100, you leave one down the middle, guy hits a bomb, people aren't going to be mad about it. But the issue with that is if you're just emptying the tank every single time, you're not trying to be as accurate, therefore you're going to spray the ball a little bit more. It's going to be high intent every single pitch.
Maybe some of this is just me being a child of the last era where pitchers threw CGs.
Mm-hmm.
I miss that, though. Like,
me too.
I really appreciate, as much as I appreciate what Jacob DeGrom does and the elite stuff guys out there, I like just as much seeing a well-crafted game.
Kyle Hendricks.
Yeah, it doesn't even have to be Kyle Hendricks. Yeah. Like, Kyle, you want to talk about an outlier. Kyle Hendricks, for the years where he found success, was about as much of an outlier as possible. But just somebody, even someone who's, like, sitting at 90, but painting. I remember watching Walker Buehler in the World Series this year, and all year long, coming off a second Tommy John surgery, just hadn't had his stuff. But he was dotting fastballs in all four corners at 96, and his command that game, the start that he had was exceptional. And I just watched, and I was like, God, they're so good. But he's also a guy who's had his elbow cut twice.
Yeah.
And has a really big scar on it now, and you know, is curious to see what he's going to get in free agency, but it certainly is not as much as he would have gotten had he not gotten cut that second time. So I feel like there's an imbalance in the game right now. We're searching for equilibrium, but we still haven't found it, and so instead we've just filled it in by putting our foot on the gas. And you know, you put your foot on the gas long enough, you're going to hit a wall.
Yeah. We've covered the new rules changes in baseball a ton in the recent podcast that we've done. Some really good, some poor shit. Holding that bat rule. Rob, let's go. But you're talking about this alone man thing, and we're talking about the other types of rules that you want to see implemented or not implemented. How has that affected the game in your eyes, and has it been good, overwhelmingly positive? Have there been some that you kind of wish they roll back, or what else do you want to see going forward?
I love the pitch clock, but that's just selfishly. You know, I do wonder what kind of an effect it has on pitchers. It's just logical to think that the faster you work, the more stressed muscles can get.
Mm-hmm.
Not saying are going to, but it can be the case. So I think more research is necessary for that. But as somebody who watches a lot of baseball games, having that extra 30 or 40 minutes back in my life on a daily basis, it's a fantastic. And I actually like the pace of the game better on top of that.
I'd also say that the human body is adaptable. So I think just logically thinking about the pitch clock, you know, 10 years from now, guys will be conditioned for it because they will have gone through it.
Yep.
I hope to God it goes to high school because it needs it. Ugh. But it's just like the shot clock. Like, if you don't have a shot clock in a high school game, like, what are we doing? So they should have enough reps where, like, the body can't adapt with that. Obviously, like you're saying, there just needs to be more time so you can see.
Yeah, and it's, you know, the sticky stuff, too. I think there needs to be more research into finding some sort of a happy medium, because if you're gripping a ball and having to squeeze, and the flexor digitorum superficialis is getting more stressed because your fingers are tight on that, like, that's a thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's just this giant stew, and I don't know if any of you guys cook, but when you're putting a stew together, you're always tasting, adding a little bit of something, tasting, adding a little bit of something. You can't ever subtract, though. And I think it's the same way with baseball. When you are pushing on something and trying to prioritize something, that's going to have consequences that you can't turn around and say, I want to undo that. There is no undoing.
Yeah.
And as for the 11-man staff, I appreciate the fact that you talked about 120 pitches. I think we've gone too far as an industry. I think that every pitcher who is actually built up and strong has the ability to throw 120 pitches in a game. I think once we're getting to 130 and 140 and 150, it's getting a little more stressful and dangerous, but the fact that 100 has become the cutoff, I think we're leaving good innings on the table from pitchers.
I don't even think it's 100 anymore. I think a lot of times you'll
like
see you cut it like 80.
80,
like,
90.
Yeah. And it's really like times through the order. Is a lot of times because of the data and the analytics.
You know, I'm so glad you bought that out.
Yeah, I'm just saying that's how it works. It's like, hey, third time through the order, your numbers are bad. We're going to take you out. It's 80 pitches. It's 80 pitches. We'll see you later.
The numbers say, though, like, they don't lie. There is truth to that. And so instead of saying, okay, there's a third time through the order penalty, shouldn't pitching coaches be saying,
How do we make sure you are as strong, if not stronger, in the sixth and seventh inning when you're going to be going the third time through?
Or what can we do to...
Yes.
To show, to get those guys out the third time through, like make an adjustment, not just Correct. Throw the same pitch over and over again. One that jumps out to me the most was Blake Snell in the World Series when he was with the Rays, and the analytics told him, told the Rays manager, he's like, hey, we got to get this guy out of here. It's his third time through the lineup. It's the second start of the series, I think. In my eyes, and this is why this really pisses me off, because baseball is a sport that if you throw a perfect pitch, that perfect pitch can still get hit. Okay, if I throw a dog shit pitch right down the middle, I can still get an out. So it goes both ways. But when you start going off the analytics, which I understand there's so much data behind it and it makes sense, you're robbing fans, you're robbing individuals of those moments that...
The superhero
moments. The superhero moments that we might not get to see. I mean, I'm sure there will be organizations that will buck that trend. I know we have a lot of Royals fans in here, but the Madison Bumgarner World Series against the Royals... The analytics, I would imagine, said, that's a bad fucking move. You know what I'm saying? We shouldn't bring this guy back a third time in the series to close out the game with a two-run lead or whatever. But they did it, and he elevated himself. And giving guys a chance.
You have to have a combination. It's the guys that can figure out how to use the analytics and, hey, what feels right. I mean, Alcides Escobar batting leadoff, everybody was, like, going ape shit, right? But Ned was like, "That's what we're gonna do," and the guy went off.
Frank, I'm not gonna stick up for the Rays here and for Kevin Cash and for what happened in that game. But I do think it's important to contextualize it. The Tampa Bay Rays play before the hurricane, at least, in a stadium that's a joke, in front of crowds that are a joke, and over the last, I think, dozen years, doing so in the American League East, have the third most wins in all of Major League Baseball. They did that by following to a T, a process that they put in place and a philosophy that they put in place that allowed them to build up a great farm system, to throw these ideas out there to players who, and let's remember, players a decade ago did not have the same open-mindedness to analytics or analytical thinking that players coming up now do. So they built a culture that was strong enough, that was underpinned by these principles and philosophies. You're telling me in the most important, imperative moment in the franchise's history that they are going to abandon those principles?
And I think that's very important because, like, especially...
You're not... I'm sorry, dude, you're not wrong.
I want,
but neither am I.
Then,
right?
Isn't it part of it too? Like, let's trust the thing that we built and like allow.
Yeah, the
this
thing
guy
they built said take Blake Snell out right.
Yeah, but they
now.
Also built Blake Snell into being the guy with the weapons to do the job.
Yes, and they knew his limitations, or they believed maybe erroneously they believed he had limitations.
Yeah.
They also saw stuff. I've tried to dissect this with people. They like quality of pitches. Was not quite the same that it was. I'm not rationalizing it. Blake Snell should have stayed in there.
Mookie Betts was 0-for-2 with two punch outs.
Well, if you're gonna play to a system, you got to stick to the system.
Stay with it.
I mean,
you play the 162 games in that system, but when it's a 7-game series or it's a
That's
wild card,
super,
whatever,
totally
then
fair.
Then you have to have
recognizing
a guy,
the moment.
No,
totally
exactly.
fair.
That's
yeah,
the guy that.
And there are if Blake Snell got his titties lit that last time through,
well,
I would have been like, yeah,
we can bring
up, take him out.
We can bring up the opposite one too, where when the Royals beat the Mets, right, he wanted to take out Matt Harvey, and Matt Harvey's in there pleading his case.
Was it
Showalter? No, it was
Terry Collins.
Thank you, but. He's pleading his case, and he lets his player make the call, and then they lose, and then he's the one that's getting crushed.
Yep.
And the Mets are getting crushed for making that move.
Yep.
And so I think whatever your identity is, you have to stick with it. And so, like you're talking about with Bumgarner, Bochy didn't do that game, and neither did the Giants. They played a more traditional thing. They said, we're going to let our dude be the dude, and if we're going to go down with the ship, and it worked. But if they would have lost that game... They would have gotten crushed for it, too.
Absolutely.
If you're in the management seat, you're the GM or you're the manager, and you do the exact opposite of the decisions you've made with
what he was just saying, being in the most competitive, free spending division, and you're spending, I don't even know what the number is, it's got to be like a third.
Yeah.
A third of the money.
Not a quarter.
And you are competing in probably just from a year on year out wins basis, probably been better than the Red Sox and the Yankees,
sure.
Wins in and wins out. Why would you do that in the most pivotal situation? Because if you lose, you have to answer those questions, and you have to justify why what you were doing actually wasn't right.
If the Tampa Bay Rays win that game, Kevin Cash managed it brilliantly.
Yeah, no, it is.
So we're looking at outcome over process.
Yeah,
and
we talked about that.
It's the reaction. That's the
reaction. Our whole what we've been talking about is consistency and process,
and not being a reaction.
Yeah, and then that's what.
No. Here's the thing, though. I'm glad Frank thinks that way because. Yeah. Honestly, if you have a group of people and they all think the same way, you're going to miss shit.
Yeah.
And it's good to have someone to challenge you and to ask, okay, why does this apply to this? Because I don't discount at all your perspective here. I think I'm a very process-oriented person, and I still think you're right.
I agree too.
Yeah.
100%. But if you're going to have a system, stick to your system.
It is important to acknowledge that on a past podcast we talked about the importance of not being reactive when we're coaching, and that is something that I am doing now, but that's because I'm a fan in this.
Frank right now has the look on his face my kids do when I scold them.
When we talked about the importance of not being reactive, is for me it wasn't like, well, why'd you throw that pitch? When you're talking about like this kind of strategy and that kind of stuff, like you said, it comes down to being surrounded by the same kind of people and everybody buying into the same theory, where it's like, as a manager, there are managers that give the players the opportunity to step up in the moment, mm-hmm. and there are managers that want to be involved, and not that they want to be the reason why they win, you know, but there's managers that understand that these are the moves that I'm going to make because I think this is going to make us.
And I think that's the checks and balances. Yeah. If I'm coaching, you're still playing, Frank. I would rather you have that mindset. I don't want to walk out there and you just hand me the ball and say, all right, cool, sounds great. You know what I mean? And so Matt Harvey thing, going back to that, like, that's a tough decision if you're the coach, because he probably knew this is not the correct move. Mm-hmm. But if your best guy is telling you and he's adamant, I need the ball, I can't say if I was him, I would have said no either.
Didn't that happen to, was it Pedro Martinez that they left in?
Yeah. They left Pedro in, yeah.
Brady Little left Pedro in, but it...
And he got fired for it, because that was the plan
the
entire time. That was what they had decided, we're doing this. Now, you're talking about the documentary on Netflix, he said, no, I was never told that. I have a hard time believing that, because when you're in those meetings, everybody's going to be on the same page. We're going to do this is the plan. Like, and if you decide to go against it, he made that decision. That's fine. You just have to live with the consequences.
In the World Series this year, Blake Treinen is out for his longest outing in terms of length and number of pitches in years. It is a high-intensity, high-leverage moment in what could be the World Series winning game. And Dave Roberts walks out, and the first thing he does is he puts his hand on Blake Treinen's heart. Because he wants to literally see, okay, what's his heartbeat like right now? And then after that, Freddie Freeman doesn't know what Blake Treinen's arm feels like, doesn't know how he's doing. Freddie Freeman essentially said to Dave Roberts, keep him in. Get out of here. And that to me, like,
that fires me up.
I know.
That's what I want.
I know.
I think that's the art to the game, right? Like, I grew up in Kansas City, so like Kelvin Herrera threw three innings in that World Series game to clinch. I think it was his only time professionally through three innings. And so at some point you do have to just say, hey, we're going to go down with the guys that brought us here.
Totally.
Now I'd say it was a little lower stress situation. They were up like 3-1. So like, close the game out. Let's go. You have a couple more shots at this, even if it doesn't work out. But I think it really just comes down to an identity thing. Like, if you're talking about the Lions, right? Like, their identity is go for it on the fourth down, and then you don't go for it, then you end up losing the game. That's tough. So,
yeah. You probably have your fingers on the pulse of how the things are going in baseball. We're trying to get fans back in the stadiums and create more viewership. Is it going well? Is it going poorly? Is there something that they can be doing better to create more fan interaction with the game?
I think it's going all right. I think the pitch clock was a great step in the right direction. I personally think the runner on second and extra innings is stupid, but whatever. I'm too old to fight about things that really aren't that big of a deal. They don't have it in the postseason.
Yeah.
That's what matters. I think an enormous part of baseball strategy going forward has to be ensuring that every single person can watch every single game. The fact that television blackouts still exist is an abomination.
Mm-hmm.
You can get every sport everywhere except baseball. You can get every movie you want, every TV show you want. Why can't you get every baseball game? Like, yeah. That's been a catastrophic failure for the league. And then I think some of it goes back on the players, too. It's just who wants to be a personality. I'm curious to see what happens with Max Clark. He's kind of a fascinating guy to me.
Okay.
Every baseball player who's under 18 years old, like Max Clark, is their spirit animal. They see him on social, and he's got his own Bruce Bolts, and...
Jack, bro.
He's what a modern baseball star could look like. He better be good.
Yeah.
You know, he's got to make it to the big leagues. He's got to perform there. But I think kids coming up now, the open-mindedness they are going to have toward marketing themselves will translate over to baseball and could be beneficial to them in the same way that it's been to basketball players who have been doing this for a long time, or to football players who don't even have to because they play football and because football's our religion in America now. Mm-hmm. Like, baseball's not going to be on that level. It shouldn't aspire to be on that level, but I do think it's more than just a local game. I do think it's the sort of thing where fans of the game should be motivated to tune in October, even if their teams aren't playing.
Yeah. Well, how was the viewership with the Yankees Dodgers in this World Series compared to? Because I know last year was one of the worst, right?
Yeah. It was good.
And it was the Diamondbacks Rangers, right?
Yeah, that was not good.
Yeah.
Dodgers Yankees was good. It wasn't as good as it could have been because it went only 5 games. So there was that. But I anticipate the Dodgers are going to be back a few times in
they
the
paid for
years.
It. Have you had the opportunity to go to any games in other countries, like Japan, Korea,
I've been in Japan.
Mexico?
I've been in Japan.
Dominican.
I did not see a baseball game in Korea. I've been to the DR, didn't see a pro game there.
Okay. Well, I've been able to play in Mexico the last couple of years, and I played a winter in the Dominican. And depending on where you're at in the Dominican, it's amazing. You talk about football being a religion in America. Baseball is your religion in the
Dominican. Where were you?
I was with the Toros del Este, which isn't one of the better ones. But we did have a chance to go to Licey and play Licey, and it's in the capital, and it is just like... It
awesome.
Is insane.
Yeah. Did you play at Kisuke is like the big stadium now.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
It's amazing. But even in Mexico, too. Like, Mexico baseball is not anywhere close to being the religion there, but the fans and, like, in terms of, like, the engagement and, like, the amount of fun that games are from a player standpoint, mm-hmm. it's off the charts. And so I'm wondering, I mean, how did Japan stack up with that? Because I imagine that's very similar, too.
Yeah, it's a ridiculous atmosphere, and I don't know that MLB atmospheres are ever going to match what foreign teams have.
Is that what? Is there nothing we can do that might change that? Or I always see like the concerts and stuff after the games where people are just dancing around and like that kind of stuff, where people are making a whole day out of it.
What would it feel like to have a Major League Baseball game with a concert type atmosphere?
I'm not sure. I don't.
I don't know. I'm serious. I don't know if I would like that.
No, but like after the game, not like during the game, but I think it would be...
No, but during the game in Japan and in the DR, it is a concert-like atmosphere. And I think a lot of it has to do with baseball's audience, right? Baseball's audience tends to skew a little old, and then it also tends to be much more of like a family event than, say, an NFL game or a college football game or something like that. And so I think there are limited... I don't think baseball necessarily wants to change that, other than let's get the average age down from, like, I don't think this is an exact, like 60-something. Let's get our average fan into the 40s and in their 50s, and let's engage a younger audience. And that, to me, is the long-term fear for baseball. In a very short attention span society, how do you engage people to spend 3.5 hours, 30 minutes pregame, 2.5 for the game, 30 minutes postgame. How do you expect to engage them for that long on a nightly basis for 6 months?
Yeah, don't you think that's the biggest problem with baseball is that the way we live, you can't follow a team 5 to 6 days a week.
You can, but it's just an investment, man.
I think it's the novelty, right? Like the NFL, it's X amount of months and it's once a week. Exactly. Like for your team. Yeah. And so it's like.
And it's fantasy.
You're building. Yeah, yeah, fantasy. Exactly. And it's, fantasy baseball. I love fantasy baseball, but it's a full investment. It takes a lot of time.
It really does.
But
too much of my time.
I think that's the point. And I think the NBA gets a little bit like that too.
Yeah.
It was 82 games and then. You're just kind of waiting for that last month going into the playoffs. And I think baseball is kind of the same way. Like, I love baseball and I watch baseball all the time, but it's like I'm super invested the first month and then you kind of like fall off. And then there's nothing worse than if I grew up a Royals fan, which we can talk more about that because you said you covered him in 03. So that was like my childhood.
04 was my first year. Like, I missed the good year in 03.
Yeah. We can talk about I think I've had like 5 winning seasons my entire life as a Royals fan. But. It's just really hard if your team's out of it in July. Why are you going to stay invested in that unless you really want to watch the farm system and the prospects and all that? Whereas in football, you drop the quarterback, you see the quarterback the next month.
Like we talked about the duration of the games being shorter and being more accessible for fans. A lot of the rules are geared towards creating more offense, right? But you can't really do both. We can't have shorter games and have more offense. Isn't that...
I don't know about that. Royals, they just want excitement.
Royals, they started the games earlier, right? On Friday?
Yeah, 6:30. Yeah.
And that's a good move.
By the way, they're trying to create more offense because of the existence of places like Premier.
Sorry, guys.
100%.
Bob Zimmer, certified asshole.
Are we going to get kickback on those $1 million contracts that our pitchers are signing?
What do you think? Is there data on? I mean, this is probably a whole other podcast, but like hitting has gone in the crapper, right? I mean, is that?
No, fact? I don't think it. I don't see. We have this argument all the time because I don't think it's gotten the crapper. It's just the incentives that make hitting
right.
Guys who get paid they hit home runs, they hit doubles, and they're driving runs. The strike like they can strike out a ton. But like the guys like Luis Arias is never going to get a $750 million contract that Soto got. But that motherfucker, I would not want to face because he's probably going to get a base hit.
I think Soto's the bad example because your example right away is like, hey, he's a contact guy.
Yeah.
Right. Well, Soto is too. He also just hits nukes. That's why he's getting paid.
What's the data on like being a bat the ball guy versus being a power guy? I mean, when the Royals won it in 15. What did they do better than anybody?
Bat to ball, but they also hit lot of doubles.
Yeah, they hit a lot of doubles. They led the league in strikeouts. Like, not
fewest
strikeouts.
So I always say it's quality contact, right? If you're a power guy, you still have to have quality. You can't strike out 35% of the time. You can't, right? So you're trying to push him down to make it enough. He's out of the league, though, now. So
but I mean, you get paid.
Chris Davis got $161 million.
Yeah.
They're still paying him.
Yeah.
But I mean, does the data say we're more productive as an offense if we have on base? It seems like we've gone to the extreme.
No.
Pitchers are going to fire the ball, so now hitters have to hit it further.
The answer is no, because if the data said that, clubs would follow it. That's what we have to remember here. All they're doing is trying to give themselves...
Is it too hard to identify that player versus the guy that has 110 mile an hour exit velocity once a month?
That's part of the stew, right? Like, how exactly do we know that a guy is going to be closer to Juan Pierre than Ben Revere, right?
Oh, Juan Pierre.
Well, here's I just... quick Google search, right? Like, runs a game. We were at 4.4, it's basically 4.5 runs a game for like the last 20 years. It spiked in 2000 at 5.1. Everything else is basically like 4.4 to 4.8.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is where my argument goes. It's not the hitting that's as much of an issue. The pitchers have gotten so good.
Yep.
If you throw 100 miles an hour at the top of the zone with high spin, I'm not saying it's unhittable, but you're just not going to be able to hit it on a consistent basis.
But it's also approach-based. Well,
don't you think there's some incentive that's gone away from being a good hitter to being a power guy?
So I would argue it's not being a good hitter or a bad hitter. It's It's guys that are going to make a ton of contact. You have to depend on the guys behind you to bat you in. Whereas if you get Schwarber, right, Schwarber's like, hey, he's hitting leadoff. We don't like Schwarber hitting leadoff. He's hitting a buck 90. He produced more runs than Luis Arias. He scored more runs and he hit more runs in. And so the goal for the teams is runs scored. So the runs scored are the same as they were 10 years ago. It's just not as fun to watch.
That also discounts the difficulty that Luis Arias poses for a pitcher when he's at the plate.
For sure.
He's awful to
pitch.
But
that's an outlier as well. He's an outlier.
He is. Yeah. He is. But I think you could coach a guy
to be closer to Luis Arias than you can coach it. Then it's easier to coach a guy to be Juan Soto.
That's a good question, actually.
Because you talk about
Luis Arias has like a 5% K rate, man. I don't know that you can coach that.
But you talk about quality of contact. Yeah. Right? My argument is that any contact has a better chance of getting hit than no contact. Obviously, I don't want a guy just being like, I just want to touch it. Just want to touch it.
What's the point of hitting before two strikes, though? You're trying to hit the ball.
But there are, like, I can either think, okay, I'm going to try and drive the ball, stay in the gap to gap, just hit a nice good line drive, drive the ball that way, versus the approaches that are now taught where it's like, get that bat underneath, launch that shit, good launch angle, okay, I'm dead pull.
I don't think...
If I get a guy that's dead pull right there, he's out.
I don't think people are teaching that as much.
He might clip me, but he's going to be out more times than not. The other guys that are hard to get out are the guys that are like, all right, he's up the middle, off field approach, right? Mm-hmm. I have to make pitches in and out. I have to go up and down. He's not going to chase.
Yeah, much. But the contradiction, right? Like we talked about this last podcast, you are not in favor for them changing the shift rule, but you want them to hit it up the middle. Well, the problem is guys get shifted that way now. The guys will get shifted towards where they hit the ball, so you can't have it both ways. You can't have it where, hey, I want guys to spray the ball over the field, but also I'm going to pitch them in at 95 and put everybody over on one side of the ball, one side of the field. You can't
lay a bunt down a couple times for a base hit, and now you can't shift.
You are the biggest pitcher in the world. Yeah. You're saying lay down also.
Barry Bonds did it.
Here's the other thing, too, though. And I think this is important. Guys have skills and tools. You don't get a guy that doesn't have a power tool and then like, well,
yeah, that's fair.
5 years later, he's got a power tool. Wow, this is crazy. That rarely happens.
Yeah, but you have guys like who throw 84 who 6 years later are throwing 97.
That is true.
That's the difference between pitching and hitting.
And so you get Luis Arias, right? He's probably never going to have a power tool. Okay, and guys that have power tools are probably never going to have a contact tool.
Make a call,
and so you're
Anderson
trying
and
to expand that.
Who here owns a horse?
Hey, you ruined my lead, and I was gonna ask Cespedes, Jason Worth, and Bob Zimmerman. What do they all have in common?
Bob texted me yesterday and says, "What do you know about horse racing?" And I said, "Not much." Now, I do know Jason Worth, and he is looking for investors in his consortium after going out and winning a Triple Crown race. I don't know, Bob, if Premier is doing well enough for you to be in at that level on horses. However, I would love to know about your horse.
Yeah, I don't know if we're Jason Worth heights yet, but yeah, we're getting into it.
What's the horse's name?
Always right.
Always right.
Is that what you say to your wife?
She is.
That's what I'm saying.
Except when it came to getting this horse. No, but the horse's name's Always Right. It's pregnant with a foal by Mattoli.
Yes.
Which, if you know anything about horse racing, you know who Mattoli is. Which
Kentucky
probably
Derby
don't.
Favorite in 2010.
No. Yeah, there you go.
Let's say you're like me.
Wait, so you have like, this is like a real bloodline.
Yeah.
Horse.
No, this is.
Oh, she's a beast.
Yeah.
That's a great family. Yeah. If anybody knows anything about horse racing, she's related.
And so are you going to raise the baby?
Yeah, right outside. Yeah. We got little stall outside of the pitching area.
Listen, this is the only facility I've been to where a dog is regularly walking around. So we got a little barn.
We're animal lovers. You know?
No, we're absolutely. The horse is housed right now in Kentucky. The baby's going to be born in February. All things going well. Knock on wood. Next plan is we've secured the rights to breed with another horse called Maxfield, who also has good lineage.
And we're just going to kind of see where this...
Yeah, Jeff, wait till you see the promo video on Maxfield. You'll be like, guys, can I get in on this?
We'll be turning you away. Sorry.
I just love that after years of doing this on the pitching side, you guys are literally breeding prospects.
Got to.
Like literally trying to birth a winner from womb to track.
Yeah.
I applaud that. I also think you can call 1-800-GAMBLER.
What? No.
Hey, when we're in the suite at the Kentucky Derby, we'll bring you with us.
You know what? I look forward to that day. It's going to be the same day my kid's thrown 100.
Well, we want to close out. Obviously, thank you so much for being here, Jeff. It's been a pleasure talking to you. I know we could probably continue to talk for many, many hours. Dakota was our last interview. We had him give us his starting nine in terms of players that he's rubbed shoulders with over the years and his favorite guys, just your favorite guys that you've interacted with in the past. Because we all know that you've been around baseball enough to talk to the best guys, but favorite people.
Here's the problem. I can't answer this because I like a lot of guys and don't want to leave anyone out. But a couple days ago, my younger son, who does not know anything about baseball, and it's hilarious. He doesn't play. He doesn't care. He doesn't like going to his brother's games. Nothing. He comes up to me and he's like, hey, someone at my school asked about Juan Soto. I was like, oh. He's like, yeah, he asked if you knew him. I was like, oh, what'd you tell him? He said, you don't know Juan Soto, do you? And I'm like, yes, you dumbass.
I'll give you a cop-out. How about you said your formative years were in the 90s with those Indians teams. Why don't you give us your favorite guys that you watched growing up? You fall in love with the game.
I have so many Jose Canseco baseball cards. I adored Frank Thomas without knowing just how good he had been.
Jose Canseco, home run and strikeout guy, right, Frank?
He was good. Those 90s Indians teams, I used to come home in, after Greg Maddux defected from the Cubs to the Braves, I would come home and watch him and Glavin and Smoltz and Steve Avery on TBS every afternoon on the Superstation. Like, I wish there was afternoon baseball still, and I wish it was broadcast on a national... Like, we had such privilege as kids doing that. Kevin Mitchell... back when he was winning his MVP with San Francisco and barehanded catching in the outfield. Oh my God, 1980s baseball. I'm just thinking of my 87 top set. Like, I was a big, big card collector and like the brown bordered 87 tops. Benito Santiago with the little rookie of the year trophy in the corner.
Throwing our guys from his knees.
Yeah,
he was so good. He was so good.
One of these days when I don't have to work, I want to just sit down and see how many Major League Baseball players I can name, and just start a list going. And
Tsuyoshi Shinjo.
Tsuyoshi. Are we just naming?
Well, I mean,
guys?
That's one of my favorite names in baseball of all time.
Mine is Jensy Sandoval. His first name, Jhensy. This is the first time anyone's ever mentioned Jensy Sandoval on a podcast. So I think that's a perfect way to end.
Yeah. Thank you again. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week. We'll have another good interview on deck. And like and subscribe.